This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Law and Behold is, of course, our monthly series, which aims to arm Malaysians with constitutional literacy and is done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar, the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law, and the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. So this month, I've got lawyers Larissa Ann Lewis and Simon Sia. Larissa is a lawyer with Azri Lee Swee Seng and Co., and she's also the director of Hak Kita. And Simon is a lawyer and director of Lawyer Comic for Change from Sarawak. And today we're going to talk about statelessness in Malaysia, an area that both of them are actively working in. So currently, children separated from their biological parents and born out of wedlock are mostly affected by citizenship laws in Malaysia. They are denied fundamental rights as a result of this. What law and policy reforms on citizenship are needed so that we can address the endless cycle of statelessness in Malaysia? Both Larissa and Simon join me today to discuss this and more. Welcome both of you. How are you today?
Hi, Julia. Thanks for having me. Hi,
good.
Simon.
Doing well?
You're doing well. Yes.
Thank you so much, guys. And Simon, of course, you're joining us all the way from Sarawak. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, as I mentioned, you know, both of you work in several capacities, actually, you know, to resolve these issues of statelessness in Malaysia. Larissa, you run an organization called Hak Kita. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Thanks, Juliet. Yes. Hak Kita is almost a year in September. It basically was birthed out of the MCO. Our tagline is empowering anyone and everyone with their basic human rights. So we take on different topics on different months and empower from the public up until the professionals on different issues. For example, this month our focus is on persons with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And next month we focus on environmental rights. Basically, just letting the public know and understand these issues, because we believe, Hak Kita believes that human rights, any part of it, everyone should know at least the basics of it so that they'll be able to stand up for themselves or another in any given situation. Yeah, Juliet.
Okay, so basically know your rights lah, Hak Kita, right?
That's yes, literally.
Okay, excellent. And Simon, you of course, you know, you're a lawyer and you're the director of Lawyer Comic for Change, LK4C. Can you tell me what you do through this organization?
Yeah, basically when you the word lawyer comic stands for us or my lawyers for change. So the organization was started back in 2016. Where a group of lawyers actually come together, we decided that we wanted to bond together to do human rights cases, to do strategic litigation as well. So we are also supporting the CSO movement here in Sarawak to give them legal advice, as well as participating in a lot of the events built up by the CSO in Sarawak. Over the years, you can see that in Sarawak, the CSO movement has actually increased leap and folds, which is very good for the whole of Sarawak.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So both of you working in your own capacity in terms of, you know, addressing these sorts of issues. And, you know, I think East Malaysia, West Malaysia, very different sort of situations when it comes to statelessness. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But let's get to this question. I'm just curious to know your thoughts on this. Nationality. Would you say that's a human right or would you say that's a privilege? Simon, you want to go first?
Yes. Nationality is definitely a human right. Without nationality, basically you have nothing at all. You cannot be in a country. And in fact, under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, under Article 15.1, declares that everyone has the right to nationality. And under Sub-Article 2, it is declared that no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his nationality. Malaysia is also a member of the United Nations, also affirmed to promote and protect the human rights under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In fact, one of the conventions that Malaysia has actually signed is the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And under Article 3, it is specifically stated that the child shall be registered immediately. The word is shall be registered immediately after birth and shall have the right to acquire a nationality. In Article 7, sub 2, the state parties, it is the state, which is the government, who have the duty to ensure that the child acquire a nationality, in particular where the child would otherwise be stateless. However, it is also important to note that Malaysia, despite being a signatory to the Convention of Rights for Children, for the Child, or in short CRC, has placed a reservation of on Article 7 of the CRC, which also means that Malaysia will not comply with this Article 7. So despite it being a human rights, Malaysia says that no, we are not going to do that. We are going to do according to what we want.
Begs the question, right? If you are a signatory, I mean, why are you putting up all these sorts of, limitations, you know, when you sign on to these things? I mean, shouldn't that be your duty to follow what is, you know, stipulated in these sorts of agreements in that sense, right? But this is what, that is our right as well, isn't it? We do have the right to do that.
Yeah, that is why we also always ask the questions to the government. Why is there a reservation under Article 7? Mm. Why are there such shuts? You can see from the movement, from the attitude of the JPN and KDN, Kementerian Dalam Negeri, when issuing out citizenship to these people, stateless children, you can see the reluctance in them. Sometimes it takes years and ages, you know. We in a way, we still don't have the answer why the government is behaving in such a way.
Mm.
So we believe that it could be political because the moment that the government comes up with this kind of policy, it will affect Sabah, Sarawak and West Malaysia. And if you read the political scenario, in fact, Sabah has a very different scenario compared to Sarawak and West Malaysia. Then you put in the Project ISIS, the problem with Project ISIS. I think that was the reason why there is such a reservation.
Okay, all right. And Larissa, you know, anything you, what are your thoughts, you know, on that question? Is nationality a human right or a privilege?
I totally second whatever Simon has said. The UDHR itself, you know, we are party to and says that it is a right, a basic human right. And we also have case law that we quote in our cases to say that citizenship or the right to nationality is a basic fundamental human right. And we often quote that in the beginning of our submissions to lay out that foundation that this is a fundamental right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So we've laid it out now as well. And now I want to talk a little bit about statelessness, right? I mean, it's a very long-standing, it's a very multifaceted issue right here in Malaysia. Maybe you can help our listeners understand what does it mean when someone is stateless? Larissa, you want to take it first?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question to kick this off, you know, Juliet, because there is a lot of misconception on who a stateless person is. They are often construed as undocumented migrants or refugees, you know. So a stateless person is actually defined under a convention. It's called the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons. There are 94 parties to this convention, but Malaysia is not a party. And if I just read verbatim on a definition of what a stateless person is, the convention states, a person who is not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its law, meaning this person has no records or identity in any country and has no papers to say that this person belongs to any other country. Whereas if it's an undocumented migrant, they are basically a non-national who has entered another country without appropriate documents. So they are still a national of that country that they left. And likewise, with a refugee, they have fled their country of origin to come to a different country. So they are still recognized in their first country, but not in the second country that they flee to. But a stateless person has no form of identity in any country or any records, basically nothing. They are, for lack of a better word, nobody.
Okay. All right. And there are large segments of the community in Malaysia who are stateless, isn't it? Children who were born here without any documents, but not considered Malaysian citizens. What are some of the struggles people face when they are considered stateless in Malaysia? Simon, you want to take this?
Yeah. Those children who are considered stateless in Malaysia, one of the biggest problems, when the moment that you are born, then after that, you have to go to school. One of the biggest problems that all these children will face is that they cannot enter school. They cannot enter public school. And despite very differing policies over the years, some schools actually says that, yes, they can bring in children without identity. But then there are some schools which will actually just not accept any of these children. So these children actually will not be able to open a bank account. So let's say right now we rely a lot on Grab and, you know, e-payments and all these things. You cannot even use e-payments. during the MCO, there was a problem with trying to get vaccinations, but eventually that was resolved. And then there were issues on how to get MySejahtera because they have no identity as well. So these children face a lot of problems. And even because you have no identity, I actually have encountered a case where it is a reported case. The name is Ivan Liao. He is already 21 and above. And because at that time he was working, but because he have no identity card, immigration actually came and arrested him and charged him in court. And because he had no representation at that time, he pleaded guilty. And when he pleaded guilty, the court actually sentenced that he be sent back to wherever he comes from. But he has no passport. He has no citizens of any other country. The immigration actually forced him to go to the Indonesian embassy and to get a passport. So you see these kind of problems where children without identity card, without citizenship, they face a lot of harassment. And recently also I was told that one of my clients' child, because of no identity, the police just stopped them and tried to harass her. This is a lady. And you see these problems, this problem is just going to get bigger and bigger because there doesn't seem to be any efforts or intentions from the government to actually resolve this.
And because they are stateless, you know, if they have children, their children will also then become stateless, right? As well, right? So it's...
Yeah, especially if you read it from the constitution that you get citizenship from your mother, if the mother is actually Indonesian or from China, you know, the child became stateless in our country, that statelessness will continue, or even child that has been abandoned, child that have no way to trace back their identity. So it becomes a bigger and bigger problem.
Okay. Larissa, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
I think I agree with whatever Simon says. I think the best way to think about it is just look at your IC, and every time you use your IC, you need it to open bank accounts, you need it to get married, you need it for a driving license. So basically without it, you can't do any of that, including get married, you know. So these are the issues that they would say they would probably face. And the most pressing one would be education.
Mm-hmm. And I would say healthcare as well, right? Access to
exactly.
Health.
And yes, of
employment
course.
Yes. Employment, which one of my clients as well, she is already 21 years old. She wanted to apply to become an air stewardess with Air Asia. She got the interview invitation. She went for the interview, but because she didn't have the identity card, she was rejected. She was really, really depressed because of that. At one point of time, I was told by the mother that she actually attempted suicide 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It was luckily the family members managed to find her and actually rescue her from committing suicide.
Yeah, that's so sad. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's not just statistics. Oh, these are the amount of stateless people. These are individuals, you know, with their lives always living in a state of limbo, not knowing. You know, not being able to do so many things, not being able to live their life, isn't it, the way we do? Before we go for a break, I just want to ask one more question. What are some of the root causes of statelessness within some of the groups that you guys have been working on here in Malaysia? Larissa, you want to start first, maybe from a West Malaysia perspective?
Yeah, so the two biggest issues that I can name is when a child is born out of wedlock. So usually the father is a Malaysian and the mother is a non-Malaysian, and a child is born before they got married. So there is a certain part of our constitution that says that if a child is illegitimate, the child is seen to follow the mother's citizenship. So most of the time, the father's citizenship or the paternity is totally ignored. That would be the first main issue. And the second issue would be adoption. When you adopt a child who has no, their biological parents are unknown. So when a Malaysian couple adopts this child, the law currently is that you have to know who are the biological parents, which most of the time is very, very impossible. But there are certain parts in our constitution that we can use to, of course, overcome this, which we will discuss later. But the main two issues that we can see that the cases that come from this side would be when they are illegitimate and when they have adopted a child who has no heritage, they don't know their heritage.
Okay, all right. And Simon, maybe if, you know, from your experience working in Sarawak, I mean, what are some of the root causes, I suppose? Yeah.
Actually, what Larissa has said are some of the problems that we also encounter here. The marriage is not proper. That is what the government always say, not proper marriage.
Right.
But then there's, in Sarawak, there is a special, we have this thing called the adat, the kawing adat. So under the kawing adat, it comes under the native laws. So in fact, in Sarawak, we do have the Adat Iban 1993, the Adat Bidayuh 1994, we have the Adat Lumpawang, and all the ethnic group actually have their own adat. And in fact, under the Native Court Ordinance, the Native Court themselves, or the Penghulu or the Tuai Rumah King, actually allow them to be married under the adat. In fact, under Adat Iban 1993, if let's say a couple, you stay in one bilik. The bilik is actually the room lah, the room in the longhouse. If you stay in one bilik for more than 6 days together, the community will actually recognize you to be married. Okay. You don't even have to register your marriage. So Adat Iban 1993 is actually a codified law, you know.
Okay.
So that piece of law is actually valid, and their marriage in that kind of circumstances are also considered valid under the Adat. So previously, what the Penghulu will do, the Penghulu will actually just write a piece of paper, you know, handwritten letters, and say that these two persons are married. But because JPN and the Penghulu and the district office, because the Penghulu, all this will come under the district office, their systems are not linked. So JPN will not have the detail that these people are actually married under the adat. So a lot of the circumstances happen, a lot of the problems happens when JPN say that they are not aware of this law, and they don't recognize this law. So that's why we actually have an example back in 2016. The first case that we actually bring public, this girl by the name of Rika Herlain. Rika Herlain, the father is a Bidayuh, is a Sarawakin Bidayuh. The mother is from Indonesia. They are actually, the village the father from is Kampung Mongkos, Seriang. Kampung Mongkos is very near to the border of Kalimantan.
Okay.
And that is why, because the border is so big, so, you know, intermarriage always happens in that area. So the Penghulu in that area actually recognizes their marriage and actually had a handwritten notes. But when the child was born, the government, the JPN actually gave her a birth certificate.
Okay.
She had no problem. She was a citizen. But when she reached the age of 12 years old, when she went to JPN, JPN suddenly went and cut off the birth certificate, cut at the side and said, oh, your birth certificate is not valid because the detail inside is not correct. So I'm going to cut this one off. I'm going to issue you a new one.
Wow.
The new one came out. She became a non-citizen on that day as well. From age 0 to 12, she was a citizen. From age 12 onwards, she was not a citizen. And then it became a problem. That's why we brought the issue up in the press and together with Sarawak for Sarawakians. We actually brought this issue up, and immediately that issue was at that time resolved. Rika eventually got her citizenship 6 months later, and we sort of had a streamline of the kawing adat. So nowadays, when you want a kawing adat, you probably have to go to the district office, and the Penghulu will actually prepare a certificate for you, and then that certificate can be sent to JPN, and JPN will actually recognize it. But you know, you're looking at this whole thing, if the things was never brought to light, nobody would have known this, and this would have become a problem. And another problem which I also encountered was there was at one time in the 1980s and 1990s. So all these children who were born in the 1980s, which is about my age, and I met them now, they are trying to apply for citizenship. They were actually sold by people. They were actually syndicate back then in Cebu. I'm not sure about other places, but I know in Cebu, who were selling children, and they were falsifying the JPN document, the birth certificates as well. And that is why it became a problem eventually when they reached the age of 12 years old, because the data was not in their computer. So these are the two problems that we actually encounter here in Sarawak at the moment.
Okay, those are a lot of problems. Oh my goodness. Okay. Okay, let's just go for one quick break, guys. And when we come back, let's talk about, you know, how someone who's deemed stateless can actually attain Malaysian citizenship. I'm speaking today to Larissa Ann Lewis. She's a lawyer with Azri Lee Swee Seng & Co. She's also the director of Hak Kita, and also Simon Sia. He's a lawyer and director of Lawyer Kamek for Change, or LK4C. We're talking about statelessness, citizenship, abandoned children. It's another episode of Law and Behold. We'll be back after this short break. You're listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture. Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me today are Larissa Ann Lewis. She's a lawyer with Azri Lee Swee Seng and Co. She's also the director of Hak Kita. And Simon Sia, he's a lawyer and director of Lawyer Karmic for Change. We're talking about statelessness today, citizenship, abandoned children. Both Larissa and Simon have been actively working to resolve issues on statelessness in Malaysia. Before the break, guys, you know, you were telling us about some of the root causes, you know, that you know, allow statelessness to sort of happen here in Malaysia. Now I just want to talk about, you know, this thing that I was reading about, you know, that the Malaysian government primarily follows a jus sanguinis citizenship regime. And also there's something else called jus soli, right, which comes into place, those two principles. Can you help explain what they are exactly? Larissa, you want to take this?
Yes. So basically, these two principles are mainly the two sides that you have to prove in order to fulfill some of the certain conditions in the federal constitution. So jus sanguinis basically means the right of blood. So it's a principle of nationality law by which citizenship is not determined by place of birth, but by having one or both parents who are citizens of the state. So i.e. your father or mother are a Malaysian. So there is a blood lineage there. Now, not only that, you need to also have jus soli, which is the right of the soil. And this is commonly referred to as the birthright citizenship, the right of anyone born in the territory of a state to nationality or citizenship. The determining factor is being the place or territory where a person was born, i.e. Malaysia. So you have to first have a Malaysian heritage and you have to have been born in Malaysia. These are the two concepts that have been very obviously seen in the case law currently, where later as you go on, you will see how as lawyers, we only try to prove that one is necessary. You don't need to have both. Yes.
Okay. All right. Simon, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah. In fact, when you think about it, there is actually case law that says that our federal constitution actually provides for both of these concepts that can be applied, jus sanguinis and jus soli. Both of these can be applied to get citizenship. You don't need to have both of them. You just need one. So that is why when you think about it, the federal constitution actually foresee that we will probably have this problem in the future, because when Malaysia became independent, I remember reading jus soli in school. I remember reading this in history as well. So this will be very important moving on when we file cases or when we argue these cases in court.
Okay, all right. And I was made to understand that the Federal Constitution of Malaysia contains a strong legal safeguard against statelessness. Is that accurate? And maybe you can help elaborate. Larissa, you want to take this?
So basically, Malaysia, we don't have a Citizenship Act. Some countries, they have Citizenship Acts. But in Malaysia, our citizenship provisions are only found in the Federal Constitution, specifically Part 3, from Article 14 all the way to Article 31. It describes a few ways how someone can become a citizen. Now, to jump straight to that safeguard, there is a safeguard in our constitution, specifically if we go into the second schedule of the federal constitution, there is one section that actually states you must not be born a citizen of any other country within 1 year. And that is all. That is all it is. And we argue that that is the safeguard on statelessness in Malaysia when the founding fathers drafted our federal constitution. However, the opposing counsels will argue that you still have to prove jus soli and jus sanguinis, even though the word parent is not mentioned, even though the word territory or state is not mentioned. Mm-hmm. So that is where our problem arises in relation to the safeguard.
Okay. Simon, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, what Larissa said is correct. I think it is under Section 1E, right, of Part 2, yeah, of the second schedule of the Federal Constitution.
Yes.
Okay, all right. And okay, so we do have that safeguard, though some would argue it's not actually. But how can someone who has then been deemed stateless, how can they attempt to attain Malaysian citizenship? Like, you know, how does it work for conferment of citizenship by operation of law on stateless persons, for example? Larissa, go ahead.
So as I mentioned previously, there are a few ways you can become a Malaysian citizen. I think it's important for me to mention this. So the audience or the listeners can actually understand this better. So Article 14 provides via operation of law, meaning almost automatically, if you fulfill these conditions, then you are a Malaysian citizen. Then we have Article 15 to 18, which is via registration, meaning you have to go to the Jabatan Pendaftaran Negara or the National Registration Department to fill up a form and register to become a Malaysian citizen. Then you have Article 19 via naturalization, which is also an application form where you have to live in this country out of 12 years, 10 years, and certain other conditions. And Article 22 is by incorporation of territory. So directly to your question, it will be under Article 14. Now, if we go into Article 14, sub 1, it's divided into A and B.
Okay.
For Part A is if you were born before Malaysia Day and you have to fulfill any of the conditions in Part 1 of the second schedule. Or Part B, which most of the cases go to court on, is Article 14.1B, which is you were born on or after Malaysia Day. That's the first condition. And the second condition, you have to fulfill any of the conditions in Part 2 of the second schedule. Now, if you go to Part 2 of the second schedule, there are 5 options there where you might fall into any of the 5. Now, if you divide the 5 into a further division, you can see that out of the 5, 3 covers people born outside of the Federation and 2 covers for people born within the Federation.
Okay.
So to actually go through all of this one by one, I think one recording or one session with BFM is almost impossible.
Okay.
But that is briefly what it is. It can get even more confusing because after you go to Part 2 of the second schedule, where you have to fulfill either one of the 5, it is subjected to Part 3 of the second schedule. This is where Section 17 comes in on the illegitimacy. Section 19B comes in on abandonment. So I'll pass it back to you, Juliet.
Okay. So we need a separate few, I think, series just to discuss this, right? But, you know, for somebody who, you know, as you mentioned, an abandoned child with no documents, you know, how do they even begin to do this? Simon, I mean, you know, what have you been seeing, you know, from Sarawak with these sorts of situations?
So a lot of the time, in fact, I think Larissa from West Malaysia, you also will experience the same situation where the children, the parents actually bring the children to JPN and try to register them. Then JPN officers, I would say this, and I apologize to any JPN officers who is helpful, but most of them are not helpful. Most of them, when they see this kind of situations, they don't talk about Article 14. They don't try and help them under Article 14. They will immediately refer them to Article 15A. Article 15A basically says that you can get citizenship, but the person who will give that citizenship to you is the Menteri Dalam Negeri, the Home Minister himself. So it is his discretion alone. So what happened is a lot of these children, when after they apply, then they don't get a reply, or even if they get a reply from the JPN or KDN, they take years, you know, you apply in 2016, you probably get it in 2020.
Mm.
Or some of my clients apply in 2017, until today they have not received anything. And I have experience with meeting some of these officers, and they actually tell me, oh, this person applied first time only. Never mind, you need at least 4 times. You have to apply 4 times before you can get citizenship under Section Article 15A. So this is just from one officer, you know, but then they seem to feel, that is their feelings as well, that, you know, to get this kind of citizenship under Article 15A, you need 4 applications. You have to be rejected 4 times, and then only on the 5th time that you will get it. But there are people who have been rejected more than 4 times. On the 5th time, they still don't get it. You see, and then when they reject, they don't give you reasons for rejection. And when they delay, they don't tell you why they are delaying as well. I have been writing to JPN and even KDN, and they actually gave us a standard answer. They copy and paste the answer. I will be telling them about how pitiful the children is. They're in such a dire situation. They'll give me a standard answer, and that just say that masih dalam semakan and dalam proses. So sometimes I just wonder, what takes so long, you know? Why do you need so long to do semakan and the process? And that is why I also want to bring this up as well. That is why I believe the women minister in Sarawak, Datuk Fatimah Abdullah herself, because of this situation, she also cannot tahan. She also cannot stand it anymore. That is why through Sarawak government, Sarawak state government, we actually came up with a task force for statelessness. She actually started a task force for statelessness where the task force will actually work together with JPN and they will go through the applications. They will check the applications, see whether the documentation is enough, whether they needed more supporting documents. The task force will actually call the applicants and tell them that if the application is documentation is not enough, please send this documentation to us. You know, the task force is actually doing these things for them. And even after the task force recommended ready to KDN, and KDN still rejects. So that is why we are wondering, what is the whole reason for not allowing, for not approving, and what is the whole reason for rejecting, and what is taking so long? So these are all the questions that we have no answer to as well.
Mm-hmm. And who decides that it needs 4 applications before? I mean, who came up with that arbitrary number as well, right? It seems it's all very arbitrary.
So that is why we don't know. Yeah, so I remember back in 2018, one of the things that we have been always asking under Article 15A is that the government, the minister should come out with a proper SOP, standard operating procedures, when it comes to approval, rejections, and the timeline for it. So we have been asking for this, but we were told that the SOP is out. But based on our experience, we don't think that the SOP is actually out.
Can I just add also, Juliet, to what Simon says? I think there is a very big misconception or misunderstanding on Article 15A and Article 14. So these are remedies available, like as previously mentioned, these are ways you can become a citizen. 15A is specifically if you are below 21. Article 14 has no time limit. So Article 14, if you bring a case to court, you can be above 21 and you can file it anytime, unless you are going through a judicial review of the 15A decision, then you have a 3-month time limit where you have to file the case within the 3 months. So many times clients would come, they are so worried. They say, oh, my child is almost 21, because they think that is their time limit. A child can only get citizenship if they are below 21. But no, Article 14 goes across to whatever age you are. And Article 19 specifically is for above 21. So I just want to not encourage, but just assure the public that there is no 21-year-old time limit for your child.
Okay, all right. And I do understand that there are a number of provisions within the Malaysian Federal Constitution that, if implemented fully and consistently, could result in the resolution of many cases of statelessness. The statement I read said West Malaysia. I'm not quite sure why, but you know, if so, what are they? Maybe you can help elaborate on those.
Right. So if you track back with me just now, like I said, Article 14B is the one we always rely on. Mm. The first two conditions we have to fulfill which is most of the time, firstly, they are born after Malaysian Day and they fulfill one of the criteria in part two of the second schedule. Now, the common out of the 5 that we always rely on would be Section 1A, which says one of the person's parent is a Malaysian or permanent resident at the time of the person's birth. So that's all. You just have to prove that either your father or mother is a Malaysian and you were born after Malaysia Day. We read it as it is. And the other part of the 5 that we always rely on is 1E, which I mentioned just now. As long as they were not born a citizen of any other country within 1 year, they should automatically be a citizen. But the issue arises here when part 2 at the top, it says it's subject to the provisions of part 3. Now, part 3, where when you refer to part 3, section 17 comes in, illegitimacy. So the arguments in court, why it's not as simple as we think it is, the word parent is argued to be lawful married biological parent. So it cannot just be a parent who's a biological parent. It has to be a married biological parent. And that is where the issue arises. When we interpret the word parent, we want to interpret it as lawful, meaning biological goes into it, adoptive parent goes into it, and the status, whether they are married or not, shouldn't play a part. But Section 17 comes and the interpretation there, sometimes the government would use to cover this word parent. Mm-hmm. But of course, we have case law in the federal court that has said otherwise. In the case of CTEB, that case actually agreed that Section 17 is part of a condition. So the word parent is to be read as married parent. However, another case that came after CTEB, which was CCH, which adopted the minority judgment of CTEB, which we argue and say that CCH should preside over CTEB, meaning Section 17 is meant to aid and interpret, but not to conditionalize Section 1A. And that is how we have been arguing it in court. And of course, Section 1E, if we rely, is as simple as the very fact within 1 year they did not have a citizenship in any other country, they should be given a Malaysian citizenship. And the scuffle there would be when the government says you still have to prove jus soli and jus sanguinis. So this is what is going on in the legal perspective. We are arguing on words, the word parent, the word at time of birth. When does illegitimacy, when does a child become legitimate once a parent gets married after the child is born? Because that's the other issue, right? Mm. The child is born out of wedlock and then the parents get married. So when does the legitimacy come to play? Does it go retrospective? That means it covers when the child was born at the time because the parents are already married now? Or does it only cover, which the government argues, at the time when marriage was registered? So there are a few, even though that last year there were two very big federal court cases, this year there are still four federal court cases going up because it goes again back and forth to interpretation, you know? Yeah. And I think Simon, you can cover on the abandonment point because that was covered in CCH. And I think that's a big issue on Sarawak as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Simon.
Yeah, in fact, when you listening to Larissa, I sometimes also wonder, you see, when the government argues in that manner, when the child was born before the parents are married, so the child is considered a non-citizen. And I have similar cases where the child, eventually the parents got married, they have other children, and then the brothers and sisters are actually Malaysian citizens, but the eldest one is not a Malaysian citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly does the government want to do with this child? Well, are you going to say that because he or she is illegitimate, so he or she should now go back to Indonesia or Philippines where the parents are not there, nobody is there with them? So you see, a lot of this application of law has no heart in it. They don't use their heart in interpretation of these things. So that's why the case in CCH is very interesting because the child is considered as abandoned. Earlier I did mention about children who were being sold. In fact, recently I have a case where the child was rescued. The child was actually rescued by the Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat, who went and rescued the child, but they for some reason they do not have the identity of the parents. So, but then they gave the child away up for adoption to another father. JKM promised that they will help to get the citizenship resolved, but the citizenship was never resolved. Now the child is more than 12 years old already. And this is the problem. That is why I think the CCH decision, the CCH and another, I guess, Pendaftar Besar Bagi Kelahiran dan Kematian Malaysia, is spot on this. The federal court, the highest court in Malaysia, actually held that once it is shown that the newborn child is found exposed or abandoned, the child is presumed to have been born to a mother who was permanently resident at the place where the finding was made. Meaning to say, if the child is abandoned, we don't know where is the parents. We don't know the identity of the parents. So we assume that he or she was born at a place where the mother is a permanently resident in that place. And secondly, the date of the finding is taken as the date of the birth. So the day we found him is his birthday. Yeah. Therefore, a child born at a hospital, let's say a child born in a hospital in Malaysia and later abandoned by his or her mother, is presumed to be born to a mother permanently resident in the Federation. The child would then fulfill the requirement under Section 1A of Part 2, read together with Section 19, Capital B of Part 3 of Second Schedule of the Federal Constitution. And therefore, the child is entitled to citizenship by operation of law. In this kind of decisions, which is a decision which we really celebrate, because the decision makes sense. The decision is realistic. And it can be enforced, and it shows that there is a way for these children. Imagine some of these children who have no, I believe it was the case in CDEB, the court actually decided that because he had a passport before, that's why he cannot get the citizenship. But a lot of these scenarios, the children, even if they have a passport, they don't have a family there. If you are going to send them over to Philippines, what are they going to do in Philippines? They don't know the language. I have a client. The client is actually, the mother is a Filipino, but he can only speak in Hakka. He cannot even speak in Mandarin properly. He cannot even speak English. Imagine sending a Hakka speaking person to Philippines. I don't think he will even pass through immigration. That's why he cannot even speak properly. Mm-hmm. So you see, that's why when you think about all these issues, it's not just an issue of law only, but it's also an issue of a person's livelihood. And the court actually recent decisions also talk about Section 8, Section 5, Article 5, Article 8, and all these decisions. There's also decisions in the Family Frontiers case, Suraini Kempe, which talk about Article 8 on equality.
Mm-hmm. This position that Malaysia takes, right, you know, on the issue of like burden and standard of proof in statelessness cases, for example, do you think that's prejudiced against genuinely stateless applicants, you know, who have difficulty satisfying the requirements that have been set out? Larissa?
Yeah, Julia, I think that was a very appropriate question, because I was just going to add to what Simon says. In the CCH case, what was also good about it, it says that any person who claims that the child was not found exposed or otherwise abandoned by the mother bears the burden of showing who the mother is. So this case moved the burden to the government to show the child was not found exposed. Previously, before this case came about, the burden was on the parents to show on advertisements to say, we are finding for the biological parents of this child, please come forward, you know, to go to all the embassies to say, like, give and issue a letter to say that this child is not a citizen of this country, of no other country, you know. So the good part about the CCH case, which is now the precedent on this law, is that the burden of proof moves to the government. Of course, they have all the capabilities to actually prove, to show if someone was a citizen or not, that's one, and to show that the child was not found exposed. Now, even though we have such a great case in the federal court here, the issue here again comes back to interpretation. What does found exposed mean? So sometimes the government might argue, oh, the child was not left in the toilet or was not left at the side of the road. So they were not exposed. They read it as literal. But for when we interpret it, found exposed can include the very fact that the identity of the mother is unknown. And it is for the government to prove otherwise, that if you know who the mother is, show us who the mother is. So this case actually has already really helped in terms of the burden of proof, to take it off the shoulders of the parents of the stateless applicants. So if you were to ask me that 2 years ago, it would have been very, very hard. But now it's slightly easier because of the shift of the burden.
Okay, all right. Simon, did anything you wanted to add to that very quickly?
Yeah, over here in Sarawak, the problem would be because of distance. Some of these officers, JPM officers in the district, they actually don't take in Article 15A or Article 14 applications. When they see complicated applications, they're actually worried. So a lot of the times they have to actually come down to Kuching. I've got people coming all the way from Bintulu coming down to Kuching for such applications. And you know, the cost coming down here is a lot. Then sometimes they say that, oh, the person who apply, you have to bring your grandparents, you have to bring your uncles, you have to bring more documents, you have to bring your penghulu, you have to bring your tuai rumah. That kind of situations is not ideal. And sometimes it feels like they are purposely just trying to make things difficult with no actually end in sight. So you don't actually see the end at the tunnel. So I feel that the burden given on the applicants itself is too big a time. But like I said earlier on, but the task force in Sarawak is willing and able to help. And yet the government still do not want to approve this application, even after the task force actually recommended it already. So why? So still a lot of questions to me personally. I find that there's a lot of questions to ask the government. Why?
I guess, you know, there are better solutions out there, isn't it? It's just whether they want to be accepted or not. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Before I let you guys go, any last message, any message you'd like to, you know, put out there to anyone listening, the government perhaps, you know, with regard to statelessness, especially when it comes to children? Darissa, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think my message has always been everyone deserves a right to be recognized. Everyone deserves the right to be seen, and whether it comes in the form of consistency in the SOP, like in a family, you can have one person who's Malaysian and the others who are not. I think consistency in the SOP in all JPNs across the country should be there as a first step. And to the listeners, be kind to everyone, whether you don't know the struggles of people, you know, there are real struggles going on. So just extend a hand. If you know someone who's stateless, connect them to someone who can help. There are a lot of NGOs, a lot of people out there who are willing to help, that there are solutions out there. Thanks, Juliet.
Thanks, Larissa. Simon, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, just a very short one. The women ministers, Datuk Fatima, actually, last month actually says that she is going to propose to the KDN, to the federal cabinet, that we want in Sarawak, we want autonomy to be able to give out citizenship. Although I find this very unlikely, you can see the frustration there, where even the state government has been trying very hard to resolve this problem, and yet the federal is not keen to resolve this problem. And I hope that whoever, if there's officers or even ministers who are listening to this, be kind to these people, because if we don't resolve these problems, Malaysia will soon one day become a nation of statelessness. It is an ongoing problem. We will have more stateless people. Probably will have more stateless people compared to people with identity card, which is very, very possible.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Larissa Ann Lewis. She's a lawyer with Azri Lee Swee Singh & Co. She's also the director of Hak Kita. And Simon Sia, he's a lawyer and director of Lawyer Kamik for Change. If you miss any part of our conversation today, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.